This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hard traveling fanboys. Nick, pick up the rest of it.
I'm not doing that. I'm just not gonna do it. You are you are the musical interlude person, not I, sir.
So do you know what they call me, Nick, around the house?
Jackass?
No, that's not it at all. This is what they say about me. Well, they don't say this about me. I say this about myself, to be honest with you. Every time I enter the room, I sing out loud to the world, I'm Mr. White Christmas. I'm Mr. Snow. I think that truly, Nick, if you had to take us, the hard-traveling fanboys, who you are listening to right now out there in the podcast world, and compare us to any two figures in history, historical figures, real-life figures that existed, I would be Snow Miser, and you would be Heat Miser.
Why do I have to be Heat Miser? Maybe I want to be Snow Miser.
You can't be Snow Miser.
Why not?
Well, because you are traditionally associated with a fiery Irish temper, and have been known to get fiery and just generally disdainful of things, whereas I am the more cold, distant.
That's not true at all. You're the bleeding heart one. You're the one who feels for everyone. Oh, I really feel bad for him. Screw people. Screw him. Especially Chandler Riggs.
Well, what better way to get you all in the holiday spirit, right? What better way than to kick off with that statement as we prepare you for a very special week before Christmas episode of the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation. Than yours truly, Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. We are here in frigid Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in the Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in the L-shaped studio. And we are here to bring you a very timely edition. See, you all thought I was going to say special, right?
We did think that. Yes, we did. That's true.
A very timely edition of The Long Book Hunters. Sorry, I'm getting some surprising computerized messages here in the L-shaped studio at my workstation that involve automatic downloads of security updates. So
I thought you were saying there were other problems, other messages coming through, and that'd be unrelated. Quite heelish of people to send you messages during the show, quite frankly.
Indeed so. And what one might say is that we are doing The Long Book Hunters on a Star Wars book. That's right. We are timing it up perfectly. The number one movie in the country, nay, the world right now, nay, dare I say the galaxy.
Ah, yes.
Is Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And it is sweeping the country, the world, the galaxy, the universe, even the ionosphere, brother. And we figured what better time to take a look at Marvel's relaunch of the Star Wars comic book line after Disney purchased the Star Wars property several years ago. And this is a book that is written by Jason Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
Longtime fans of this show know that we're both fans of through his work on Thor, Southern Bastards, and various other sundry titles.
How did I know you were going to say sundry? I just knew you were going to. That's remarkable.
We have that ESPN, and sometimes even that Fox Sports 1 between us.
Nobody wants Fox Sports 1. Nobody. Not even Fox Sports 1 wants Fox Sports 1.
Evidently. But nevertheless, we are taking a look at this Jason Aaron story, and on art was John Cassidy, who I believe is probably most well known for causing my voice to crack for a moment, and also for his work with Joss Whedon on Astonishing X-Men back in the day, mm-hmm. and also some prominent Captain America stories. Am I correct in that?
I believe so, but I'm certainly not up on my Captain America chronology, so you may be asking the wrong person.
Let's just stick with Astonishing X-Men.
Yeah, let's do that.
And say that he's famous for his run on that, and he's the artist on this book, and we are reviewing book one, Skywalker Strikes. Is that the name of it, Nick?
It is indeed.
So, I guess we should explain what this series represents. So for years, the Star Wars books were being published under, what was it, Dark Horse?
Yeah, Dark Horse had the rights. Before that, I believe it was IDW. They had bounced around. And
before that, it was Marvel, the way back in the 70s.
All the way back in the 70s, after the release of the first movie. Marvel actually had the license, and they were the first stories told outside the established film canon. You could almost look at them as the first, you know, the opening salvos in what would eventually become known as the Star Wars expanded universe. You know, a universe that has been wiped away after Disney's purchase of Lucasfilm. But, you know, Star Wars comics have long historical ties to Marvel. And once Disney acquired Lucasfilm and brought it under the same company as Marvel, you knew it was only a matter of time before they decided to start publishing Star Wars comics again. To their credit, they let Dark Horse finish out the books that they had already had in production. At the time, a title simply titled Star Wars, written by Brian K. Wood, and also an adaptation of George Lucas's original Star Wars script entitled The Star Wars, which, if you're not up on your Star Wars script versions, drastically different than what we wound up getting. So, yeah, like you said, it was just a matter of time before they decided to start publishing the books themselves. And once they did, back in 2000, I believe it was 15, they got off the ground running with this one and also a Darth Vader ongoing, which we reviewed the first volume of, I believe, last year.
To coincide
with the release of Rogue One. So just decided to sync up a little bit here with another Star Wars theatrical release by taking a look at another Marvel-published Star Wars comic.
Absolutely. And in this case, Jason Aaron is taking over a title that is taking place in a time frame between episodes 4 and 5. So between A New Hope, the original Star Wars movie, and the second in production Star Wars movie, which was episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. So in between those two movies is when this is taking place. And help me out with the timeline here, Nick. Is this closer to the end of New Hope or closer to the beginning of Empire?
Much closer to the end of New Hope. Pretty much the implication is that this is one of the first few missions that the Rebels take on after the events of A New Hope. Because I think we're over 40 issues deep now in the Star Wars in this run, and we have not yet reached the point of Empire Strikes Back. So clearly we were much closer to New Hope than we were to Empire.
Indeed. And as we pick up this story, basically we're picking up right at the end of New Hope. So you've got Han, Leia, and Luke together with R2-D2, C-3PO, and Chewbacca, your main cast from A New Hope. And in this case, they are working together to infiltrate what is purported to be the largest weapons manufacturing base in the Empire, the Galactic Empire. And to do this, they are going undercover. This is where we started out. And they're trying to sabotage this weapons base. And along the way, they get into some hijinks. They encounter Darth Vader, who makes a very foreboding appearance here as a negotiator originally, who then finds out that the rebels who dismantled his fleet are on the planet. So he's after them. We also get appearances in this book from lots of Star Wars fan favorites. Boba Fett pops up, Jabba the Hutt pops up. We also get introduced to a few new characters, such as Han Solo's as yet previously unidentified wife, and a couple of other new characters. There's some Empire underlings that we meet along the way here. But really, by and large, this is kind of drawing on your nostalgia, right, Nick? This is seeing the old team back together, going on an adventure together, and still getting to know each other, still getting to trust each other as they all have their own motivations for what they're trying to do. As Leia is attempting to win the war for the rebels, maybe a little bit too zealously. Mm-hmm. Han is attempting pretty clearly to win the affections of Leia, even though he's not being obvious about it. That seems to be his primary motivation. And Luke is trying to find his place in the world, trying to figure out what it means to become a Jedi and to avenge both his father and old Ben Kenobi, who were struck down by Darth Vader, or so he's been told. So a lot going on here, but picking up all the threads from the original Star Wars movie. And right off the bat, we're thrown into a nostalgic whirlwind here.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like you said, it definitely plays off the nostalgia because it's kind of taking you back to some of those, not just the characters, but as you mentioned, the character dynamics from early in the franchise. You still kind of got a Luke Skywalker that is a little bit unsure of himself and a little bit of a farm boy. He has not, you know, gained a whole lot of wisdom in his short time. You know, he was able to pull off the unthinkable by destroying the Death Star, but he's still kind of naive in many ways, and still kind of thinks that just charging headfirst into situations is gonna wind up being the best thing for him at various times. Then, of course, like you said, you've got Leia, who has an almost single-minded focus on helping the rebellion overthrow the Empire. Of course, you've got Han, who, as you mentioned, is definitely angling for Leia's affections, but is also clearly seeking to amass some personal wealth to help get him out of the situation he finds himself in with Jabba the Hutt back in Episode 4, you know, the bounty on his head and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about the nostalgia, really the thing that draws the greatest amount of nostalgia for me is John Cassidy's art. And that's not because I have any great affection for John Cassidy's art, but because his art in this title is so borderline photorealistic that it really takes you back to the younger versions of Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, and Harrison Ford, and they really look like they just stepped off the movie screen all the way back in 1977 and walked straight onto the page. It is uncanny at times the job he's able to do in terms of depicting the three main leads, especially Mark Hamill, because for those of you who aren't aware, sometime shortly before the filming of Empire Strikes Back, Mark Hamill was in a fairly serious automobile accident that caused some damage to his face. Now, it wasn't drastic damage, but there's definitely a physical difference between Mark Hamill from A New Hope and Mark Hamill from Empire Strikes Back. And the amazing thing is, despite having much more source material to pull from in terms of using, you know, to create his reference material, John Cassidy almost perfectly recreates the 1977 version of Mark Hamill, and it's just phenomenal at times, the art in this book.
Totally agreed. I was blown away. I always liked John Cassidy's art, don't get me wrong. He was great on Astonishing X-Men. He's been good in every book I've read of his. But I feel like this is almost on a level beyond that, what I've seen in the past. And to be so photorealistic with the faces, to make it feel like I'm actually watching the movie, you know, and we'll talk about the dialogue in a minute and how that helps that. But to look at the facial expressions and see how, whether they're mad at each other, whether they're joyous about something, whether they're terrified or scared or pensive. There's a particular panel that I want to draw attention to, I can't remember if it's in the last issue of this, issue 6 or issue 5, where Leia and Han are bickering back and forth, and Leia makes Han agree to accompany her on one last mission, and if he does, she will provide him the spare parts he needs to repair his ship and escape to resolve his own little situation with Jabba. Now, after she says this and he agrees to it, she goes, but what after? What about after you get the parts? And there's this look of like, it's just vague enough of whether she is longing for him to stay or whether she's just genuinely curious, and it's right off the screen. It's just perfect, the facial expression of her, the facial expression of Han. Really good stuff throughout this book. The sets look amazing. And speaking of photorealistic and getting the actors from a certain age, he really does a great job of getting the Jabba from 1977, who didn't, you know, let's face it. I mean, they tried to make him look younger, but he aged significantly in the later movies. So to see that actor, Jabba, who plays Jabba, still in his youthful form is quite breathtaking.
Ah, yes. Greg always been a fan of Jabba. I don't know why, but I think perhaps Greg finds a commonality with Jabba that I can't quite put my finger on.
Well, perhaps it's our mutual love of the television show Jake and the Fat Man.
Or your mutual love of bikini-wearing 1983 Carrie Fisher.
Well, quite frankly, I would suggest that you resemble that remark.
Quite frankly, I would suggest that any red-blooded male in America resembles that remark.
Which begs the question, Nick, that we've never addressed on the show. Would you consider Star Wars to be a slice of Americana?
It's a good old-fashioned slice of Americana.
Very good. I also appreciate Jabba's penchant for slobbering on himself while eating. So that's always good to see. Speaking of slobbering on oneself, I have to bring this up while I'm talking about slobber. For those of you who are longtime listeners, you may know that both of us are fans of the Austin Powers franchise of films. And recently, I was watching the trailer for the upcoming Winston Churchill movie starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. And as Gary Oldman is in Fat Man makeup to play Churchill, watch his bottom lip in the trailer and notice how it glistens with saliva. And tell me it doesn't look just like Fat Bastard's lip, bottom lip in Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, particularly as he drools as he stares at Mini-Me and dreams of eating him.
And also, speaking of slobber, for those of you who haven't, go and watch the Woken Matt Hardy promo from this past Monday's Raw and see the massive amount of slobber he manages to somehow get into his own hair in the course of the promo, which is quite remarkable.
Quite remarkable. Woken wisdom at its finest, ladies and gentlemen. And pay close attention to the Napoleon complex joke that's made in there, which I very much appreciated. Anyhow, this is all off topic of what we're talking about, which is Star Wars. And as any project is that tackles these original characters, it's going to be rooted in nostalgia, and it's going to be playing on nostalgia. And for the most part, it does this to extremely potent levels in a good way. And we talked about how important the art was to this, but I also want to talk about the dialogue, as I mentioned a minute ago. Jason Aaron is the writer here, and he is, by and large, an excellent comic book writer. And I was very impressed with what he does throughout this book, throughout this trade. Taking these pieces and writing them in a way that sounds just like they're on-screen counterparts. Nick, I don't know if you would agree with that, but to me, I really could hear the actors' voices when I was reading this book.
Oh, I totally could as well. The one that I could hear most vividly, that it seemed to me, anyway, like Aaron had the best handle on, pretty much every Han line he writes sounds like something Han would have said back in A New Hope. It's just amazing, his ability to really capture that tone and that feel of what made A New Hope so special in his dialogue and in his settings. It's, I mean, just an incredible job by Jason Aaron, who we praise all the time on the show, but this is another example of him. It's interesting because with this book like Star Wars, you've got to be able to take it and provide us with something that feels familiar enough and yet doesn't feel like it's rehashing things we've already seen. So you got to kind of marry those two together, and he does a brilliant job of that.
Totally. And whether it's Han, as we mentioned, whether it's Leia, who every line came off with just the right amount of bitterness and snap that she has in A New Hope, and then Empire later on, Or whether it's Luke, who gets the hero's journey, of course, who we're identifying with, and Darth Vader, who every – I have to admit to doing this, Nick. As I was reading this story over the last few days, every time Vader would speak, I would do my best James Earl Jones voice to read the line aloud to myself. I couldn't help it. I just couldn't help it. And I didn't add any breathing effects. But I did do the voice, and so it was so much fun, and everything felt in character, everything felt in line. All of his every line he delivers feels like a Vader line. And sometimes in the comics that I've read of Star Wars over the years, there has been a tendency to rewrite Vader lines with Anakin in mind versus Vader. And to me, I feel like his speaking pattern and the way he talks gets much different once he becomes Vader. And I really appreciate how Aaron embraces that and kind of leans into the menace of Darth Vader.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. And Vader here has numerous standout scenes, whether it's, you know, conversations he's having with people and the way he just intimidates everyone he comes into contact with, or whether it's his action scenes, or whether it's a key scene I think we'll get to eventually at the end of this volume that I just absolutely loved.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's probably the best scene in the entire volume, and that's saying a lot because there's a lot of great scenes to be had here. You know, there's so many standout moments for Vader. Boba Fett, who's a character both of us have kind of laughingly dismissed over the years, actually gets some really cool moments here, where he is sent on a secret mission by Darth Vader to uncover information about the rebel pilot that blew up the Death Star, mm-hmm. Who we know to be Luke. So Boba Fett goes to Tatooine and is basically torturing people to try to get information about who this farm boy was that blew up the Death Star. So he's got some really cool moments in here. More cool moments in this book than he gets in any of the movies, by the way.
Yeah, because in the movies, I mean, that's one thing about the Star Wars fandom is over the years, you know, as I discussed on the recent Star Wars The Last Jedi Place to Be Nation Pop Special Edition review that was produced by myself, Todd Weber, Tim Capel, Jennifer Smith, and Russell Sellers, available right now on PlaceToBeNation.com and on the Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed.
The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, one of the whatever. You know all the things. You're a better shill than I. You do it for a living, after all. The point being,
go Trojans.
The point being, Boba Fett, as I kind of state about other characters in that podcast, Boba Fett is a character that the fandom just kind of created this massive movement around when really his on-screen time doesn't warrant it, honestly. Like, Boba Fett went on to play a major role in the expanded universe because fans became so intrigued by him just based on his look and the few lines he had in Empire and Return. And so here is an example of Aaron knowing that there are some massive Boba Fett fans out there, and giving the character a little bit more of an expanded role.
Were Star Wars fans as intrigued by Boba Fett as Vince McMahon was by the Sandman?
Nobody has ever been as intrigued by anything as Vince McMahon was by the Sandman.
Interesting. I guess the modern Boba Fett would be Captain Phasma, right? The kind of really well-designed character that looks cool but doesn't really have much to it. So, but people still kind of flock to that character and you know, turn it into a big deal. It happens, you know. There's a lot of cool-looking characters in Star Wars, you know?
Admiral Akbar is a great example of a character that...
Oh! How do you not grow attached to Admiral Akbar? I mean, from it's a trap to being a giant catfish man, or whatever kind of creature you would call him. He's just a delight. Yeah. But he doesn't appear here, actually.
Unfortunately, no. But I'm sure he will make appearances in future installments.
We do get an appearance from Mon Mothma,
yes,
the enigmatic leader of the Rebel Alliance. Actually, Akbar does appear in this very briefly. There is a rendezvous between Princess Leia and Admiral Akbar and Mon Mothma, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yes, and Akbar, as is his seemingly his lot in life, he is warning of a potential trap if they go. That's a pretty good joke now that I'm thinking about it. Oh man, that was good on Jason Aaron's part. He's warning Leia that she can't get too aggressive, lest she possibly fall into a situation that could be something not unlike a trap. So we get a lot of fan favorite characters that appear in here. No Emperor, sadly, but we do get all the ones that we've mentioned. We get a pretty thrilling escape sequence involving the hijacking of an Imperial walker, which is cool because this would be one of the first times in canon that we've actually seen the walkers in action.
Mm-hmm.
So, very cool scene there. We get some space travel. We get Luke on a journey of discovery as he goes back to Obi-Wan's house on Tatooine to attempt to uncover any secrets that are left behind that might instruct him on how to become better with the Force. Importantly, and this is actually, I don't know how we've gone this far without mentioning this, this book has the first canonical one-on-one encounter between Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker, face-to-face.
Yes.
Vader doesn't know who Luke is yet. He just knows that he's a boy that's involved with the Rebel Alliance. They have a very brief one-sided duel that Vader just demolishes him in. And the implication is made that with a snap of his fingers, Vader could end him at any moment. And it's a pretty important moment in the Star Wars canon if you take it as being canonical and put it into the context of the other movies. Because if you're watching the movies, Empire is the first time we see them go face to face, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that also goes very badly for Luke.
Indeed, it does. He takes his hand. Vader has to take his hand off to him, of course. But
and then of course, Vader went back home and flew his pigeons.
Flew his pigeons, indeed he did. But yeah, so you're right. There is that aspect of it. And I know you questioned. You asked me off air if that sat wrong with me, and honestly, it didn't because you know. This is technically canon. The idea now is that everything that is published by Marvel or by Lucasfilm, now that it's under the Disney auspices, will be canon. Like, everything will be one story, there will be no contradictions. But, you know, honestly, at a certain level, that only works, you know, for a certain audience. Because only a certain portion of your audience is going to pick up a Marvel comic book. Only a certain portion of your audience is going to read the standalone novels that fill in the gaps and stuff. Only, you know, most of your audience is only going to experience Star Wars through the television and film properties. And so I kind of view it as you can take it either way because it doesn't necessarily impact Empire Strikes Back in my mind.
Like, it flew out of the Sarlacc pit. Yes, we also get a Sarlacc. What a great moment, a reference to the Sarlacc, and some really cool allusions here, by the way, that Jason Aaron makes, some parallels to the prequels that tie in the prequels in a way that we haven't really seen in the films since the Disney takeover, where, in fact, you see the a scene where Vader is on Tatooine to negotiate with Jabba the Hutt, and as Jabba and Vader are sitting there watching this duel, Jabba is explaining to Vader everything he knows about this boy that took down the Death Star. He says apparently he was just a farmer here from Tatooine who came from those sand pits below. Who would have thought anyone of note would be born on Tatooine? And there's like this panel shift where it shows Vader like contemplating as he stares down below. Very cool allusions there. And there
a cool
is
parallel because it almost mirrors the opening scene of Return of the Jedi as well.
Yep. Exactly. And there's a great moment that I think you were talking about. Probably the biggest reveal in this one, shocking reveal, is this is how we finally see how Vader learns that Luke is his son. I think that's never really been explained in canon, and so I think for people that just watch the movies, the implication is that Vader must have somehow just figured it out based on the Force or something in between A New Hope and Empire. But here we find out how he discovers this, and I don't want to reveal exactly how it's done for people that want to read this book, but it is really... It leads to the best scene in the entire book, and it's in the very last chapter, and very few words are uttered in this scene, Nick. It's one of the least reliant on actual dialogue scenes in the entire book, and yet it's my favorite scene in the entire book.
And what's really cool about it is if you're reading both this title and the Darth Vader solo title that was being published around the same time, it's one of the few scenes that appears in both titles because it's so important to both the overall narrative mm-hmm. and Darth Vader as a character that you kind of have to have it in both places. So we actually got to talk about the scene a little bit last year when we did our review of Darth Vader Volume 1. But yeah, it's a very important scene where Boba Fett reports back to Darth Vader and basically tells him he was unable to apprehend the pilot who blew up the Death Star, but he did get a name. And when he tells him the name, that's when Vader realizes who Luke is, and he winds up using the Force to, you know, to borderline shatter the window of a Star Destroyer, stopping just short of sucking himself out into space, which would mean certain death, right?
You would think, yes, that being sucked into the vacuum of space would certainly spell doom for Vader, which would have been self-defeating, I would think.
You would think that, yeah.
Undone. Once again, Anakin would be undone by his fiery Irish temper.
What is up with you and fiery Irish tempers today?
I've been watching a lot of old 1890s boxing.
James the Gentleman Masher Corcoran.
Exactly. You know, he was undefeated until integration. It's amazing.
Oh, God.
Then he never won again. But, oh, it's a sketch, folks. Look it up on the internet. It's great. But that would require NBC putting their clips up for free. Anyway. Vader gets his big reveal there. It's awesome. And I was going to say, another thing about that scene is as you're watching it, if it makes you feel better, if you're a big fan of the prequels, you can insert your own, no! If you feel the need. I didn't, but you can if you'd like to.
If George Lucas had been the editor on this book, he totally would have, by the way.
You need to have in red letters, starting with all caps, and then the O's will get smaller and smaller as they trail off panel. And then when we start the next chapter of this series, we're going to pick the O's up as they travel.
By the way, Greg, you mentioned earlier you weren't really sure how Vader found out that Luke was his son. The Emperor actually tells him on screen via hologram in Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. But I think there was – I can't remember how that scene plays out, Nick. I always felt like there was like some sort of feeling that he already knew, maybe. I don't know.
Certainly that now.
Certainly that now, yeah. But maybe that's retroactive application of knowledge. but yeah, and it also – yeah, that's another great – as we've talked about, Nick, Palpatine is the one character in the entire series that is improved by the movies continuing, like retroactively. Like Empire and Return, he's there and he's a presence – but you only appreciate the totality of his character once you examine all the other films, the prequels, even the extended universe as well. But the prequels and the comics that have come out and stuff like that, they really add up to this, you know, the Clone Wars show. They add up to this tapestry of deceit that runs strong in our boy Palpatine, who I know we're both quite fond of as a character.
Indeed.
But he's not in this. Vader is, Han is, Leia is, Luke is. Chewie's in this as well. My favorite supporting Star Wars character, C-3PO, has a pretty funny subplot here where he gets disassembled by natives on this planet where the weapons factory is, and he is seemingly hallucinating about being in the presence of Wedge Antilles, which was humorous to me. What did you make of the use of the droids, 3PO and R2, in this one?
Oh, always great. Always great to see, especially 3PO. You know, it's a little bit harder to convey R2's right. attitude in print as it is on, you know, as compared to on screen. So R2 doesn't get as many moments to stand out as he does in most of the other films. But 3PO gets all of his trademark humor in and is used to great comedic effect. So... big fan of the usage of 3PO in particular.
Now, there for the most part, this is a very good, enjoyable story. I very much enjoyed it. There were a few little details here and there that bugged me. For instance, one that I mentioned to you off the air is in the first chapter, the three of them are all the three main characters are in disguise as these traitors from the Outer Rim who are coming in to negotiate with the Empire and waiting on Vader to arrive to be their negotiator. Little do they know. Well, at a certain point, they have to reveal themselves and blow their cover to knock out some of these guards. They do, and then in the very next panel, they're running down the hall, and they're all in their iconic outfits from A New Hope. Leia's in her flowing white robe. Han is in his vest and shirt and pants combination. Luke is wearing something, like his normal like flight jacket and everything. And it kind of bugged me, Nick, because I was like, they had all this clothing on underneath the clothing they were wearing to impersonate these Outer Rim pirates. So that was just a very pretty minor thing, but it's one of those artistic details that I wish had been addressed.
Yeah, they were basically foregoing logic for the sake of getting them into the classic costumes from A New Hope as fast as possible to further that nostalgic feeling. So I understand why it bothers you, but it didn't bug me very much because I understood why it was there and I gave it a wink and a nod, you know. So
it's kind of like one of those attention to detail things. Kind of like you know, you'd see this on like a Saturday morning cartoon when you're kids, like Ninja Turtles or whatever. They'd always have their costumes on underneath whatever disguise they were trying to go in or what have you. So, but yeah. Humorous to me, but yeah, that was one. And then otherwise, it was pretty good issue. I thought I would have more problems with Han Solo having a secret wife than I did. I thought the way it played out was kind of vintage Han to me.
Yeah, and there's more to it that they eventually revealed to make it make even more sense and to be less annoying or less contradictory with the pre-established canon.
Right. So, yeah, I enjoyed all of this. It was very entertaining. It was a quick, breezy read. Didn't take long to finish at all. If any of you out there have not encountered this Star Wars universe from Marvel, I've only experienced two series out of this, two trades, the first Darth Vader trade and this one, and I would highly recommend both. I think I can't speak to how it is now, but I can tell you it got off to a great start, if these are any indication, and really high praise from me for both this opening Star Wars arc and, of course, the Darth Vader book we reviewed last year. Nick, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, to answer your question about how the quality of them was long term, the entirety of the first Darth Vader series was fantastic. This one, because it's a more long term ongoing, certainly has its ups and downs, but for the most part, is a very entertaining read. But if we're just talking about this first volume, I absolutely loved it. Jason Aaron's dialogue, John Cassidy's art, all kind of combined together to make, you know, just a beautiful, loving, nostalgic, you know, ball of fun set back in the timeline of the original trilogy. So hard for anybody, even the most casual of Star Wars fans, I think, to not find something to enjoy here.
Totally. Well, with that being said, we're kind of on a little bit tighter time frame this week because of the holidays coming up. So we're going to call it right here. We don't have much else to add. Very good book. Let us know what your thoughts are on Marvel Star Wars. Do you like the direction they're going in? Do you like this series itself? What are your thoughts on these characters going forward? And maybe tell us some – this is a fun question to throw out to the listening audience. What are some creative teams you'd like to see tackle a Star Wars book? You give me a fantasy Star Wars book you'd like to see by Marvel and ongoing. Nick, I know this is, you know, right, very putting you on the spot, but what would be a Star Wars ongoing comic series you'd be interested in, or even a limited series and a creative team that you'd be interested in doing it?
Oh, that's a tough one, but how about we keep just the main Star Wars title, let's flash it forward to being in between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. And if we're going to go fantasy creative teams, let's shoot for the stars and go Ethan Van Sciver and Jeff Johns doing a Star Wars title.
Oh. Well, if Warner Brothers keeps treating him the way that they are at the moment, then, stranger things have happened, my friend. That would be awesome. I guess I'll throw one out, too. And I'm going to try to go for the people that are at Marvel right now, which is, or maybe they could return to the fold in the near future. Let me say, let me get a Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino, and let me put them on a, damn, I put myself on the spot here and I've lost my my mojo. Let's put them on a story about, you know, I know they've done this book before, and they've had a series about it before, may still have it ongoing for all I know, but let's put them on an Obi-Wan series. See how that goes.
You know, interestingly enough, there has not been an Obi-Wan standalone series. There has been an Obi-Wan and Anakin five-issue miniseries that takes place between Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, but nothing with Obi-Wan standalone.
Well, there you go. Do that. In fact, and I'll even give you the time frame. Put it between episodes 2 and 3 and give us the story we never actually got in the movies of Anakin and Obi-Wan becoming friends and actually getting along and having fun together. Mm-hmm. So that's my fantasy pitch. Well, give us a fantasy pitch, folks, and give it some thought. Let us know through Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Email gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. Join our Facebook page. We will let you in as long as you're not a spam bot. And let us know your thoughts on this, all of this, these topics. We'll address more later on in the show. We're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we're going to have the rundown for you. I don't know if we'll have reading and watching.
I actually have a little bit of reading, so.
All right. Well, we'll have a little bit of reading from Nick. And stay with us. We'll
promotional
be right
consideration
back.
Consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others available on PlaceOfNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceOfNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceOfNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Okay, Polly, you ready to play a little bit of music?
No.
Now, this is the Nick Winter Show, and I do the entertaining. Thank you. Let's go out with something really hot for these folks. A big hit out of 77. Star Wars. Nothing but Star Wars. Give me the Star Wars. Don't let them end. Star Wars. If they should Bar Wars, please let these Star Wars stay. And hey, how about that nutty Star Wars bar? Can you forget all the creatures in there? And hey, Darth Vader in that black and evil mask, did he scare you as much as he scared me? Ah! Star Wars! Those here in Bar Wars! My seventh winner up here! Star Wars!
Welcome back to the hard-traveling fanboys, the Longbook Hunters. We are finished with our discussion of Star Wars Volume 1, Skywalker Strikes, and we are ready to delve into our weekly segment. And we're going to kick it off with our weekly look at what we've been reading and watching. It's a segment, Nick, that we like to call Reading and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What have you been reading and watching? Tell us.
So, I have not. I have been buying. I folks, don't ever get behind on your pull list, no matter how minuscule it may appear to be. Because if you do, you may walk into your friendly local comic book shop and walk out having spent $157.25, which is what I did recently. Just last week, as I left my job, I decided to be a good sport and catch up on all the books that I haven't bought, and instantly regretted it, and instantly made changes to my pull list to accommodate for such an occasion. So I picked up a ton of books, haven't read them yet. I'm bringing all of them home with me to Mobile. Maybe I'll get a chance to read them over my Christmas vacation. So, Nick, what have you been reading?
So I actually have four books. So for the first time in a long time, we're going to go top three, bottom one. It's been a while. Start with my bottom book, Green Arrow Annual Number 1. Not that I didn't enjoy this one. It's just that there's another book on my list that I'm going to talk about here in a minute that was very similar, and I just thought that book was a little bit better done. But Green Arrow Annual Number 1 kind of tells the story of all these different members of Team Arrow with Roy Harper, Ollie, Diggle, and Amico all kind of being exposed to these visions of what their ideal lives might be around the holidays. And then, of course, they realize that these visions are not all they appear to be, and Dinah eventually pulls them out. It's all, you know, it's all fine and well and good. It's just it's not as good as the other three books on my list. So Green Arrow Annual Number 1. Was still a book I enjoyed. At number three, I've got Aquaman Annual Number 1. This is, I don't know who this was written or drawn by, quite frankly. Somebody with the last name of Johnson wrote it, and somebody with the last name of Fiumara drew it. And to be honest, the art I didn't love. It kind of had a weird, surrealistic quality to it about it. Like, the faces were all kind of weirdly shaped and stuff. At times, it looked a little bit like a Tim Burton movie, you know, with the way the faces were, and just odd to me. But yeah, sorry, I got distracted here for a minute. But yeah, so it's a book that is kind of like the Aquaman version of For the Man Who Has Everything. That classic Superman story involving the Black Mercy and a vision of what Superman's life on Krypton might have been like. And here we see Arthur, an older version of Arthur and Mira, who have essentially accomplished all their goals. Atlantis is now a fully recognized member of the international community. They have a new city, the city of Crownspire, that exists both above the surface and below. That is the embassy of Atlantis to the rest of the world. And they have a young son named Tom, named after Arthur's father. And what happens in this book over the course of the issue is they progressively grow to realize that something just isn't right. And it's eventually revealed that they and several other members of the Atlantean court have been under the influence of the Black Mercy that was found deep at the bottom of the ocean. And so the book, of course, has to end as the way all Black Mercy stories do, with Arthur and Mira finding their way out. But it has this really heartbreaking panel at the end as it shows Arthur and Mira sitting on the beach in front of the lighthouse mourning their son, who wasn't real. But you got to remember, in their heads, they lived 8 years with this kid and saw him grow up. And now they realize that that didn't actually happen. And so It's a very heartbreaking, melancholy close to the story, but a beautiful story nonetheless.
Sounds like a great twist on what is, controversially enough, my all-time favorite Superman story.
There you go. At my number two spot, I've got Batman 36. Yes, I think Tom King is killing it on Batman, but that's neither here nor there. This book kind of features...
I guess if you don't like coherent plots...
I must not like coherent plotting.
No.
So, anyway, this book features dual conversations. One conversation between Batman and Catwoman, and the other conversation between Superman and Lois Lane. Both of them having parallel conversations about the fact that Bruce and Selina are engaged, and Bruce has not officially called, you know, one of his best friends, Superman, to let him know. And it's just conversations between the two couples about the situation and kind of about what differentiates these two men. Very simple issue, but one that I thought was extremely well done.
Can't wait to read it, Nick. It's actually, of all of the Tom King Batman issues since I dropped it from my list, this is the one that I'm most... this and the annual that I did pick up, actually, last week, are the two that I am most excited to read.
And speaking of the devil, my number one book of the week is Batman Annual number 2. It's called Date Nights and Last Rites. And what this is it opens with a scene of current Bruce and current Selina having a playful couple argument about where they first met. And so we then flash back all the way to their very first meeting, and we see how that plays out. And that's all great stuff, don't get me wrong. But it is the closing of this book, the last third of this book, that really drove it home for me. As we see the return to Batman art of Michael Lark, and he draws the portion of the story called Last Rites. And we see the middle point of the Batman-Catwoman relationship. We see the beginning, and then we see what Tom King is showing us, you know, his version of the end of that relationship and how it ends. And it is one of the most heartbreaking things I've read in comics in a long time. It is beautiful and tear-jerking, and it really just, if you are even the slightest fan of the Batman-Catwoman dynamic, you will feel something reading these last 12 pages of this. It's incredible. Some of the most emotional comics reading I've seen in a long, long time, even knowing that it's a, you know, potentially just an alternate future that never comes to pass. So outstanding job by Tom King.
The book that you compared it to me was the, you know, what we've called one of the best single issue comics of all time. The, Green Lantern, number 20, I think it was, by Jeff Johns.
Specifically the epilogue to that book.
Yes.
Not really the rest of the book so much, but the epilogue. You definitely get to see these different characters. You don't get as much on each individual character because the focus is so completely on Bruce and Selina, but you see all these different characters and how they have aged and how they are affected by what is happening to Bruce and Selina, and it's a tough read, man, and I don't mean that in terms of it's not high quality. It's just it is an emotional, gut punch, especially near the end.
Would this be near the top of your Tom King Batman issue list?
Oh, absolutely. Without question, yeah. Without question.
Terrific. Looking forward to it. And that brings us, I believe, to an end of your reading list. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And on watching, I have not watched anything comic-related, but we did say, I don't want to step on any toes either, so we're not going to talk long about this.
Yeah.
We're not going to talk long about it, but, you know.
And I already got to give my thoughts over on the Sellers Points podcast, or not Sellers Points, but the Place to Be Nation Pop Special Edition review of The Last Jedi, as I mentioned earlier in the show. So my thoughts are out there, but yeah, Greg, it'd be good to get your thoughts real quick for those who might be interested.
Yes, I'm going to be completely spoiler free. I don't think it's soon enough to be going into spoilers for me right now. If you have seen the movie, I urge you to listen to the podcast that these guys recorded and lady recorded, which is up now at Place to Be Nation Pop on all the various feeds and on PlaceToBeNation.com. You can get all the non-spoiler and spoiler thoughts of everybody involved. I will stay non-spoiler, and I will just say a little underwhelmed is how I left the theater. I liked the movie overall. I think there was a lot of great stuff in it, but there was a lot of stuff I didn't like, which surprised me. And I think what surprised me the most of all is just how I felt like it was dragging on at times. And I've never felt that way. Even when I was younger, watching episodes 1 and 2 in the theater, I didn't feel that way. And I felt like there were times when I felt myself thinking, God, when is this thing going to get going? Or when is this thing going to end? And I never have thought that during a Star Wars movie. And so I don't want to paint it in too negative a light, because there is a lot to love here. Mark Hamill gives the performance of a lifetime in this. He is, I mean, just mind-numbingly great. And there's several other great performances. Adam Driver is great. It's amazing to see Carrie Fisher, and really heartbreaking to see her on screen, given that, you know, that she passed away just last year. And so there's so much to love in this movie. There's also a lot that bothered me in the movie, from a character perspective, primarily. The visuals are amazing. I definitely recommend going to see this as soon as you can in the biggest and best theater that you can, because it has some of the best visuals of any Star Wars movie, some of the best action scenes of any Star Wars movie. I mean, it's just visually stunning. I mean, Rian Johnson did an amazing job of putting this together from a visual standpoint. There's some really surprising twists and turns. I think one of the shocks to me is I wasn't as shocked by anything that happened as I thought I would be. I was surprised, I think, a little bit, but I think my investment in these characters and some of these reveals wasn't enough for me to get too worked up one way or the other about them. So I don't want to say any more than that, but because you really do need to experience it for yourself. I think for the most part, there were a lot of good performances. I thought there were some lackluster performances, and I think the story was good, even if it served a few characters, to me, a little bit at the expense of several characters. So I think ultimately for me, I would say I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it. And I've loved most of the other Star Wars movies I've seen on first watch. And that, yes, that includes episodes 1 and 2. I was younger. I was 15 for episode 1, and I was however old I was, 18 for episode 2, and loved them the first time I saw them. And I'm sure this is going to hold up better than those two movies for sure. But I think, at least on first watch, I would have to put this middle of the pack of Star Wars movies for me.
Yeah, you know, my thoughts, I expressed them over on the Sellers, again, did the Sellers Point thing again, on that podcast, but I'll say in brief, I enjoyed the movie more than Greg did. Pretty much all the major twists I was down with, because I think I was a little bit more invested in some of the new characters that were established in Force Awakens than Greg was, but there were definitely things in the movie that did not work for me. Vastly more things that I loved than there were things that I disliked. So the movie still rates overwhelmingly positively for me. The problem is I am just a Star Wars junkie. I love most things that Star Wars has put out, most things. So with the glaringly obvious exceptions of episodes 1 and 2, this kind of falls with, for me, like Greg said, into that middle pack where I have Return of the Jedi and Empire as a clear step above, and I have Attack of the Clones and Phantom Menace as a clear step below. And this, I don't really know where it falls into, but it falls into that pantheon with Revenge of the Sith, New Hope, Force Awakens, and Force Awakens for me. So kind of a little bit of muddy water there in terms of separating those four. But it's in there. It's a movie I like a whole hell of a lot. And it's a movie, like you said, I think will stand the test of time better than some other entries in the franchise will, particularly the prequels.
Yeah, so we'll, you know, I think at some point we'll probably, maybe when we come back from the holidays, we can revisit and talk a little bit more in depth. But again, for now, if you want spoiler talk, go to that podcast that Nick referenced. For now, go out and watch the movie and judge for yourself. Don't take the words of others. Go and watch and see how it makes you feel, and get back to us, and we'll all talk about it at a later time. And with that being said, that wraps up Reading and Watching. Let's get into our weekly look at the PN news and notes of the comic book world. A little segment we call... The Rundown. Where should we begin, young Nicholas?
I think we ought to begin where we've began for the last few weeks, as it shouldn't take too much time to get through this most newsworthy topic since we've talked about it so much in the past.
Yes, and that is that it's finally, we promise, it's finally official, with a caveat. Mm-hmm. So Disney has acquired Fox, 21st Century Fox, for $52.4 billion. Put into perspective how much that money is, it's a lot. That's all I got for
a
you.
Lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Disney will assume, I don't care about the net debt, I don't really care about all that stuff.
Yeah, the debt just kind of, I guess you could technically say that they acquired it for a net value, something like $65.7 billion in terms of total value, but that's really not important.
All that matters is that the company's in good hands.
Yes.
I always screw that line up, Nick. Damn it.
The important thing is that our company's future is secure.
Thank you. Idiot! Like Chris Farley. Anyway.
And you look like him, too.
Hey. Don't insult Chris Farley like that. But unfortunately, there are still some hiccups, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, I guess. There are still some hiccups that could intervene in this little do-si-do between companies. Mm-hmm. For instance, a Senate committee has called for an investigation into the buyout, and I'll tell you more about that as soon as this page loads. Top members of the House and Senate antitrust subcommittees have called for an investigation into Disney's proposed buyout of 21st Century Fox, citing anti-monopoly laws, this according to Variety. Mm-hmm. I would assume that they've covered their bases here, but I think it's at the very least worth investigating. I don't think anybody should be upset that this investigation is going on. I think it's a good thing. They should make sure of what the ramifications are going to be of this, make sure that it's in the best interests of people that aren't just comic book nerds or aren't just fans of movies or TV, but people that are watching the overall media landscape and the overall business landscape, what this could represent. So to me, go through your due diligence. I don't think there's any reason to get in a hurry about this. And on our end, as fans or for people that are, you know, I'm kind of in the middle on it, but for people that are very excited about this, it's probably still going to happen, but if it's determined to be an antitrust violation, then it shouldn't happen. So that's kind of my take on it at this point.
I have very little expectation that this will turn out to be any sort of antitrust violation, not because it might not potentially be an antitrust violation, but just because of the current political climate we live in. I'll leave it at that. I don't see this being overturned personally, but stranger things have happened. But I know one of the creative concerns that you had leveled about the deal the entire time was that, you know, creativity might be stifled a little bit, and certain films that Fox had been doing might not happen at Disney. And I think there was a report that came out this week that should have set some of those concerns of yours to bed a little bit, right?
Perhaps, if you can believe a CEO and chairman at his word. As you know, we can always do that. CEO Chairman Bob Iger of Disney had this to say related to R-rated Marvel films, particularly Deadpool sequels. He says, "Deadpool clearly has been and will be Marvel branded, but we think there might be an opportunity for a Marvel R brand for something like Deadpool. As long as we let the audiences know what's coming, we think we can manage that fine." Now, that's exactly what people like me wanted to hear, that we're concerned about this. And if you extrapolate beyond that to what would it mean to have a Marvel R brand, think about a movie version of the Marvel Max imprint from the comics. This could potentially open the way for characters like Moon Knight, characters like Ghost Rider, characters that might benefit from a harder-edged approach to the movies than from what we get from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And hey, I'm all about that. I think that if that's truly the approach they're going to take, which I think time will tell on whether that's actually going to be a thing. I'm not really sure what you know. As long as the audience knows what's coming, I think they kind of already do. I mean, that's what the ratings are there for. Yeah, I'm excited about that. I think that's exactly what I wanted to hear. I think that's we've seen that it can work, and we've seen that variety is a good thing. And I think Marvel, right, or Disney, whether it's Disney or Marvel is making this call, ultimately it's Disney, but Marvel has shown a tendency and a willingness in recent films to take more chances, to swing for the fences a little bit more. And I think from a content perspective, like you've said recently, they know what's good for them, and they love making money. And Deadpool is a character right now, Wolverine is a character right now that are making money. Go for it. Now, whether they will eventually cave in to the thought process that a PG-13 movie can make more than an R movie by its very nature and decide to go from there, we'll see. But for now, hey, I like what I hear.
Yep, absolutely. So where do we want to go from there?
Well, I think we should
stay on the film side, perhaps?
Well, I was going to stay on the Marvel side, but let's stay on the film side. All right. And let's move over to an independent title, not independent, that's wrong terminology, an Image Comics creator-owned title by a fan-favorite creative team, Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. It's called Kill or Be Killed, and it's gotten rave reviews from pretty much everyone who's read it. Place to Be Nation Pop's own Russell Sellers and David Sunday are huge advocates of this series. Well, it looks like it has been optioned for a live-action feature film by John Wick co-director Chad Stahelski and his production partner Basil Exposition, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Screenwriter Dan Casey has written an adaptation of Brubaker and Phillips' Incognito series and has also signed on to adapt this one. It's the fourth Brubaker Phillips project in active development for a live action film or TV series. I haven't actually read Kill or Be Killed yet. I have the first volume of this book, but Brubaker and Phillips are an amazing team. And I can tell you that I've read Fatale. It's amazing. I can't say enough about this team, Criminal, etc. So I'm super pumped for this, and you could not have got a better director for it by going to one of the John Wick guys, because John Wick right now is the standard bearer for action in Hollywood, and you're seeing that from some of the assistants on John Wick that are getting to do their own films now, because that's how groundbreaking the action was in that film. So I'm really excited about this, Nick.
Yeah, I have no real feelings about it, because I neither have read Killer Be Killed, nor have I seen John Wick, so I have no real perspective to offer on any of these topics. I just threw this in on here because I knew you had a little bit of perspective, being the massive John Wick fan that you are.
Indeed. You have, however, seen the voodoo takeoff version called John Wickin, correct? Mm.
Yes, I have. John Wickin, which is quite good.
Indeed. Now, from there, we're going to move on down to the World O Comics, and we're going to start by going in and giving our fellows at DC a little bit of attention. We haven't talked about them yet in this episode.
No, there's no mind-numbingly stupid news coming out of the DCU corner today, so very little mention of DC on the podcast.
Hey, they gave us an early Christmas gift. By not doing something idiotic. Yes. Exactly. Well, this news is kind of interesting. Action Comics is approaching its kind of landmark, not kind of, it's approaching the most landmark issue of any comic. It's going to reach its 1,000th issue, which is obviously unprecedented in comic books. It kind of started the whole genre that we love so much. And it is approaching issue number 1,000, and which was originally supposed to be out in March. Well, that has now been delayed to April 18th, which will be the 80th anniversary to the day in which Superman debuted in Action Comics number 1 back on April 18th, 1938. Action is releasing alongside a companion hardcover book. It goes over the history of the title and the characters, edited by the great Paul Levitz. No details, no solicitations yet of the actual issue. But Nick, this is kind of cool, man. What are the odds they'd be able to get it on that exact date?
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised they didn't plan this from the get-go to just have it then. You know, originally it was solicited for a March release, but if they knew April 18th, the 80th anniversary, was going to be a possibility, I'm a little surprised they just didn't do that from the jump. But glad they thought better of it. Too cool. You know, a one-month delay is no big deal. And especially, they'll probably need the extra time. Because I'm imagining, for issue 1,000, this is probably going to wind up being a 80 or 90-pager, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, it's going to be enormous, no doubt. And will probably involve a lot of A-list creative teams.
Probably so. Probably so. And there's no problem with that.
Absolutely. But one of the things you find in these news stories is a lot of things are just a matter of perspective. One man's trash is another man's treasure. One person's bad news is another's great news. And so, as Marvel giveth, Marvel taketh away. And we present to you, for your edification, two stories that, depending on your outlook, may fall on the same side of the spectrum or may fall on opposite sides of the spectrum. To start out with, we're going to talk about a bummer of a story that came out just today as we record this, and that is that the longtime Thanos creator, the creator of Thanos, the man who has guided this character's journey through Marvel Comics from the time of his inception through all of the Infinity books that led to the version that we're getting on the big screen today. That is Jim Starlin. He has announced that he has officially cut ties with Marvel Comics. And this comes on the heels of just a few weeks ago, he was doing interviews to promote his new series of graphic novels that were supposed to end his run on the character. He explains in a Facebook post on his page, there are reports that Marvel pulled him off the Thanos OGNs, original graphic novels. Starlin says that's not the case. He pulled himself off of the books because they made it clear they weren't interested in using him on any of the tie-in series to the movies or the regular series, even though he lobbied heavily for it. But that's not why he pulled out. He said he left the books because and will not work for Marvel anymore because of a dispute with Marvel editor Tom Brevoort, who has been something of a firebrand at times. He's very well loved by a lot of people, but he's also had some conflicts with people in the past. And here's the story, according to Jim Starlin. We don't know the other side of the story yet. I'm just going to read this, and I know, Nick, you make fun of me sometimes for reading the quotes, but I feel like I wouldn't do this justice without reading it in context. So, he says on his Facebook page, quote, "What I objected to and what will keep me from doing any further work for Marvel Editorial was Tom Brevoort approving a plot for the current ongoing series, which was pretty much the same as the Thanos story arc in the graphic novel trilogy Alan Davis and I have been working on for Tom for close to the past year. He had 200 pages of script and 100 pages of pencils on this project when he gave the green light to a strikingly similar plot." Skipping ahead a little bit here. "At first, Tom denied giving his approval to the plot. When that turned out to be false, he switched to claiming that there was nothing similar about the two plots. When that didn't fly, he changed the story to it was all an accident. These changes of excuse and other bits of procrastination ate up a month, by which time the current Thanos ongoing art team was too far along for anything to be done about the situation. Too bad for me. I am moving on. And yes, Marvel Entertainment has treated me very well and very generously, and I like them." So his issue is not with Marvel Corporate. His issue is with one editor in particular. We don't know what really happened. We're just going off of what Jim Starlin said. But the way he describes it, I can't blame him for walking. I can see that being extremely frustrating for a creator.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those instances where it's clear that despite all our calls for the original graphic novel to play a bigger role in the future of comics and the publishing industry, it's one of those instances where it's clear that they are siding or falling down on the side of the monthly series over even the work of a legendary creator like Jim Starlin, and that's just really unfortunate. It sounds to me like something that could potentially be patched up down the road if it was just somebody other than Brevoort working on the books with Starlin. But for now, unfortunately, the creator of Thanos is kind of ushered off to the side.
Yeah, it's hard to blame him, and you also have to feel bad for Alan Davis, or was it Alan Davis or Alan Grant? Let me double check
Alan
that.
Davis.
Yeah, you have to feel bad for him because 100 pages of pencils is significant, and
I would think he would still be paid at least some money for what he is.
Right, I would hope so. I would hope so. But as we mentioned earlier, as Marvel taketh away, it also giveth, and. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Duke's multimedia role continues as 2017 comes to an end. Whether it was the death of his most hated character from The Walking Dead, whether it was the Georgia Bulldogs winning the SEC championship and a berth in the college football playoff, what else is there, Nick? Things have just been rolling for you lately in terms of multimedia.
They really have. New Star Wars movie in theaters, hard to beat right now. Been a pretty good month of December. Fair, decent, not too shabby.
Well, it just keeps getting better. Because, for Nick Duke anyway, right now, Marvel Comics is teasing Dan Slott's last Amazing Spider-Man story. In March, Dan Slott will kick off what looks to be his last Amazing Spider-Man story, titled "Go Down Swinging." Solicitation says Dan Slott has saved his most harrowing Spider-Man story for last. So we don't know if this is actually going to be the end of his run, Nick. But if it is, how will you look back on it? And most importantly, how do you react to this news?
Well, I look back on it as a steaming pile of shit for the most part. And I react to this news by saying, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Go take your Twitter trolling ass over to some other character and ruin him for a decade.
What if he goes and does Batman?
What if he does, Greg? Then I'll just read other Batman books. I'll enjoy my Tom King and James Tynion Batman and not be subjected to Dan Slott hijacking the entire character for a prolonged period of time the way he did with Spider-Man.
I think we really, we've seen Batman as a rich billionaire who broods at night. I think we need to see what would happen to Bruce Wayne if he lost his fortune, but gained a child's laughter. The greatest gift of all.
Or if he became the Joker, or if he became Mr. Freeze.
Ooh! What would happen if the Joker inhabited the body of Batman? Mm. Would it change the Joker fundamentally to his core?
One has to think so. No, Dan Slott, it's just... Listen, long run, I know some people like it. Not for me. Not for me in the least, and I'm glad that perhaps there will finally be a core Spider-Man title that I can actually read. I've been away from the book for, God, since Brand New Day would have been in, what, like 07? So I've been away from the title almost 10 years now, and it's a title that I don't really, like, I don't relish not reading it. Like, I want to be up on what's going on with Peter Parker, and it's just been story direction after story direction that I can't get on board with, and I'm hopeful that they'll at least have a creative team I can find some hope in so that I can come back and at least check it out, because I've been clamoring for this for a long time, and it looks like it's finally going to happen. Although, if his storyline doesn't kick off until March, he probably won't be off the book until fall of next year. So, long time for that to be in the works.
Indeed so. And I'm not a regular reader of Spider-Man anyway, but I will say that Dan Slott's Spider-Man... the story, the overall directions, judging by solicitations, I can't judge the individual books themselves, but they've not been for me either, for the most part. Particularly, Peter Parker Industrialist has right. not been for me. So I'm happy to see some new voices get in there and maybe take it in a different direction. So, but I know a lot of people did love his run, so it's going to be monumental regardless. So for those who are looking forward to that, be sure to check it out. With all that being said, I think we're out of items this week in the rundown.
We are.
We closed on a low note for some and a high note for Nick. So Nick, your role is continuing in the new year. What else could happen in this last 2 weeks of the year that could really you know, even make your 2017 that much brighter?
Well, the Atlanta Falcons still technically have a chance to clinch the division by winning their final two games, even though they're in third place right now. And the final game would be played on the last day of 2017. So there's always that possibility to repeat as NFC South champions. Trying to think what else. I don't know. All I know, Greg, is this month has been a shoe-in for my favorite month of the year.
Maybe Christopher Nolan will come out with a surprise announcement that he's directing Green Lantern Corps for Warner Brothers.
Oh, whoa. Oh.
Yes. Oh, and I should let our – I'm sure that everyone's been waiting with bated breath to hear what's going on in the fantasy football world of of the hard-traveling fanboys. And our seasons have come to a disappointing conclusion. We, despite being two of the four highest-scoring teams in our league – both of us are on the outside of the playoffs looking in and are forced to play in a consolation round. But I think I speak for everyone in the league when I say that our impending head-to-head matchup next weekend to determine fifth place in the league is actually the championship.
Yeah, and you got a little lucky when the Packers went ahead and shut Aaron Rodgers down for the season. You got a break that went your way, but that's okay. My team is positioned well for the future regardless of this weekend's outcome.
Absolutely. I had a little bit of a shakier time with my opponent this week than I expected, but I'm confident going into the finale. I think we're going to have a good game, and hey, you know what I say, Nick? May the fifth best team win.
Indeed.
So, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we hope you have a very Merry Christmas, a very Happy New Year, a Happy Hanukkah, everything else under the sun, whatever holidays you celebrate this year, we hope they're wondrous. And we have a special Christmas gift for you guys next week.
Indeed we do, as we have a very special edition of Countdown, taking a look back at 2017 as Greg Phillips, myself, Russell Sellers, Jennifer Smith, and Andrew Chandler Fraser Garner all count down our top five comic book movies of 2017 in a rare in-person roundtable. So we'll be bringing that to you next week.
And the one thing that I think we can all say is let's pray that it is a filtered edition of what happened that day.
Now, Greg, let's not.
We shan't tell tales out of
Skule, which you are on the verge of doing a little bit, but
no, nothing like that, We hope you all enjoy it. We hope you have a wonderful holiday break. We, along with our good buddy Tim Capel, recently watched Ernest Saves Christmas, which we shall not be reviewing for this show, but I would urge all of you to go out and watch it and maybe find out a little bit about the true nature of the human capacity for love and joy as embodied by Ernest P. Worrell.
You are listening to the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
Hard-traveling fanboys. When you hear this show, you better run for cover.
Klondike Bill's a sausage lover.
I got a 10-inch kielbasa from Klondike Bill.
Hard-traveling fanboys.
Slobber.
It's a weekly podcast and you better listen.
Keep your ears in mint condition.
Ooh, hard-traveling fanboys.
You got a 33-in-3rd chance of winning.
Hard-traveling fanboys. Hard-traveling fanboys.
Our traveling fanboys.
Got two weekly segments coming to your town.
Reading, watching, and the rundown.
Do-do-do-do-do-do.
Thank you.
It's the greatest show on Place to Be Nation.
Certainly a unique situation.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboys.
Oh, they're pretty, they're skittles.
Hard traveling fanboys.
You vicious little son of a bitch.
They're indivisible. They're microwavable.
No, Mr. Eddie.
Ooh, hard traveling fanboy. Oi, 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 oi.
Are you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question. Give me a minute.
Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well-kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
I believe it was quite sudden, and thank you.
Hard traveling fanboys. Hard traveling fanboys.